week, American History TV sits in on a lecture with one of the nation's college professors. You can watch the classes here every Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern and Sundays at 1 p.m. Next, history professor Susan Shulton discusses the causes of America's Civil War, including President Abraham Lincoln's refusal to allow slavery to expand into new territories. Professor Shulton explains that Lincoln refused to recognize the Confederacy as legitimate and viewed secession as illegal. This 90-minute class took place at the University of Denver.
Back to the end of the fourth week, where we are finally in a position to answer two of Ken Stamp's questions related to the causes of the Civil War. If you remember, the first question Ken Stamp asked was, what caused the ceaseless agitation between North and South throughout the 1850s? And then he separated out a second question, which was, what caused the Gulf states to secede immediately after the election of Lincoln? And if you think back to the last few weeks, we've done an enormous amount of preparation and study about several different crises in American life throughout the late 1840s in through the late 1850s. What I want to try to do today is bring all that together so that we're in a position to answer that, particularly that second question. Why was the election of Lincoln in 1860 so severe in the minds of some Southern slaveholders that they took the ultimate decision to withdraw from the Union? And that's what I'd like to focus on today. And I was thinking about this, if you remember, we covered the election of 1860 on Tuesday, and last week, the crises of the 1850s. And I was thinking about all of those as a chain of causation that led up to the war. And I thought about what if questions that I often like to pose to you, even though they're impossible to answer. What if the United States had not engaged in war against Mexico, which, as you remember, brought an enormous amount of territory into the American West, and which became a sore spot for the future of slavery? What if the North hadn't acceded to the Fugitive Slave Law as a central component of the Compromise of 1850? And then, more importantly and more immediately, what if Stephen Douglas hadn't decided to introduce the Kansas-Nebraska Act, right? What if that motivation simply hadn't occurred to him and he found other ways to court Southerners, right? Had he not introduced the Kansas-Nebraska Act, there wouldn't have been the kind of impetus that we saw in the North galvanized around a party that was dedicated first and foremost to halting the extension of slavery, right? And Fehrenbacher asks that question squarely. What if there had been no Kansas-Nebraska Act? Might there have been no response in the Republican Party? And even more specifically, what if Southerners had simply chosen to let Kansas go? As we saw, there wasn't a lot of interest in actually taking slaves to Kansas. They made it a point of pride in terms of recognition of their property. It was a principle to them. But by making it such a principle, they created enormous interest and sentiment, anti-slavery sentiment in the North that really coalesced around this new Republican Party. Okay. Now, as most of you wrote in your papers, all these things did happen, so the what-if questions are limited. And all this brings us to the breaking point of the election of 1860. And I want to say a few words about that to recap what we talked about on Tuesday. First, as you realized from looking at the data, this is an unprecedented election in American history, right, for several reasons. First and foremost, the major party broke into two pieces, right? The one party that had been holding the country together, the Democratic Party, had been a cross-sectional, sort of cross-regional party, right? The one last national institution, because by this time the churches had broken up, the Whig Party had broken up. It was really the Democratic Party that was the last institution of cross-sectional alliances. That entirely broke up around Stephen Douglas, right? Now, why was it that Douglas couldn't rally Southern Democrat support? The anger at Douglas over the Lecompton Constitution, over his objection to the way that the pro-slavery legislature had unfolded in Kansas was so great, the anger at him was so great that they couldn't get over it, right? Even though Douglas is really their best hope remains in the Union. He is the one who's dedicated to protecting their rights as slaveholders, right? But as we saw, first when they meet in Charleston in April, and then when they meet in Baltimore in June, they simply can't come to an agreement. And I was wondering about that last night, so I actually went back and I read the party platforms of both the Southern Democratic Party and the Democratic Party. And you might be surprised to find out, or not surprised as the case may be, that there's only one plank that differentiates the two parties. They agree on everything: a transcontinental railroad, a transcontinental telegraph, right? The one thing that separates them is the degree to which the party is willing to protect slavery everywhere, right? The Democratic platform recognizes the Dred Scott decision. That is to say, they recognize that the Supreme Court has upheld the rights of slavery as property, and therefore property can go anywhere in the territories. The Southern Democrats want more than that. They want recognition that slavery is property anywhere. And as we talked about last time, even so far as to propose a territorial slave code, a federal slave code that would protect their rights everywhere as slaveholders. Okay? That one plank is what differentiates the two parties. And you think, is that really enough to force the Southern Democrats to walk out? But apparently it is, right? So that we have a situation where there are essentially two elections going on. One in the South between the Constitutional Union Party and the Southern Democrats, and one in the North between the Democrat Douglas and the Republican Lincoln. And just like I implied to you last time, I actually went back and read the Constitutional Union platform. And the Constitutional Union platform begins with the preamble that platforms are evil. Platforms are meant to deceive, and platforms should be taken with a grain of salt. And all they really say is that we will uphold the Constitution of the United States, and that's the best way to protect the rights of Southerners. So really, like we said on Tuesday, all they're really after, right, is loyalty to the Union and the upholding of the Constitution. It's too controversial for them to say anything beyond that. And for what it's worth, the Southern Democrats say nothing about disunion in their plank, their party plank. I guess that would be obvious, right? You wouldn't be running for president on a platform of secession. But we know that before the election occurs, they squarely line up behind John Breckinridge. And John Breckinridge believes in loyalty to the Union. It's only after the election, right, with the results of the election, that all hell breaks loose. Okay? By the middle of October, it's pretty clear which way that election is going to go, and it's extremely counterintuitive to us today, right? The idea that a party that is entirely centered in one section of the country, right, could dominate the entire presidential election. But in fact, that's the case. The Republican Party sweeps. Lincoln wins 55% of the vote in the free states, which translates into 98% of the electoral vote. Right, which is a good reminder here in 2012 as we enter another election year. It's not about the popular vote. So take that with, when you read polls, take them with a grain of salt. The Republican Party Lincoln only gets about 40% of the national popular vote. But it turns out, given the demographics of the country, the population boom in the North, particularly in urban areas and western areas, it really doesn't matter, right? And perhaps that's the point when all is said and done, that the election of 1860 is really a statement to Southerners, particular Southerners, right, that their vote literally doesn't matter. Once upon a time, that was okay, because to the extent that there were Southern Whigs, there were also Southern Democrats, and Southern Democrats had allies in Northern Democrats. And remember, all through the 1850s, the Democratic Party is incredibly powerful. It's riding a wave of dominance throughout that decade in the White House as well as in Congress. And perhaps Southerners felt fairly comfortable about the influence they were able to exercise within the Democratic Party, right? But 1860 shows them that the trend they saw in 1856, when Fremont outpolled Buchanan in the free states, is actually far more consequential, right, in 1860, when Lincoln actually wins the White House. So one of the things I want you to think about is this. We always ask the question, why does disunion come in 1860, 1861? But last night I was thinking, given the election and given the power of the Democratic Party, we might ask the reverse question. Why didn't disunion come earlier, right? Was it the power of the Democratic Party, and to a lesser extent the Whig Party, that actually prevented secession at certain crises that we've seen in the past, such as 1850? Or 1854, or even as late as 1856, right? It's the power of that party as a cross-sectional institution that really, I think, keeps the South or certain Southerners, right, in the Union as long as they do. So we get to 1860, and Lincoln is elected president. I think within 3 days, South Carolinians begin proceeding toward disunion, begin taking steps to separate their state out of the country, okay? And by Christmas, this act is complete. South Carolina has declared itself outside the Union. So you have that great document, South Carolina's Declaration of the Causes of Secession, which, as you see, is modeled on the Declaration of Independence. And that tells you so much about how they see what they're doing, right? How they see themselves as the political and the intellectual heirs of the Founding Fathers, right? Which could not be more opposite than the way the Republicans see the situation. And we have to figure out why that is so, okay? So South Carolina makes their decision by the end of the calendar year. That same month, December of 1860, there is a frenetic amount of activity in the nation's capital trying to figure out a way to avert a secession crisis. Because at this point, it's just South Carolina. As you saw in your documents, there's all kind of other machinations going on, right? Mississippi actually has a secession commissioner, which tells you something about them being ready to hit the ground running. And they send that commissioner to Georgia to try to foment secessionist sentiment in December. But so far, it's only South Carolina that's taken official action. In the Senate in December of 1860, John Crittenden is the one who heads up the compromise efforts. He is the one who actually takes the seat of Henry Clay, the architect of the Great Compromise of 1850. And he too sees himself as perhaps the person anointed to bring the Union back together and avert a military conflict over secession. And he puts together a series of constitutional amendments and legislative acts that he hopes that together will be sufficient to form a compromise and avert a crisis. You read some about this today. The most important elements of it, in my mind, are one, that it's a reinstitutionalization of that 3630 line across the West to the border, the eastern border of California, right? It's a way of reinstituting that geographical line. Above that line, slavery will never be permitted. But below that line, the United States government will never interfere with slavery. And this is going to be considered a constitutional amendment that is unchangeable, right? And if you read the Crittenden Compromise pieces carefully, you see that the way Crittenden words it is that anything under that line is open to slavery, even if it's not part of the United States, right? And this is precisely the time that the Democratic Party and the Southern Democrats, by the way, had their eye on more territory, particularly Cuba, as a way of expanding slavery, okay? That seems to me one of the crucial elements. It also reintroduces the slave trade in Washington, right? And generally forces the federal government to step back on the issue of slavery, right? And the regulation of slavery, okay? Now, as you know, the outcome of this, the Crittenden resolutions fail, right? The Crittenden compromise fails. And it seems to me that's the last point at which there's an opportunity to create some kind of peace negotiations before the political momentum of secession really heats up, right? The larger question, of course, is whether any compromise was possible at all. When you look at the position of the Republican Party, right, when you look at Lincoln's inaugural address and you compare it to the documents of those secessionists, right, Stevens, Harris, and the Declaration of South Carolina, is there any area in which there can be real compromise? And there was furious attempts to really get at that. Lincoln was fairly hands-off about this as president-elect. He repeatedly said, there will be no compromise on the extension of slavery. And beyond that, he refers people to his debates, all the statements he made against Douglas in 1858. He hasn't changed his position, right? But as you'll see in the inaugural, there are ways in which he's willing to meet Southerners, right? But there's also ways in which he's not willing to be flexible, okay? So, in January of 1861, things really begin to heat up. And that's where you saw some of the data, and you're able to think about the data that tries to correlate the pattern of secession relative to the demographics of slaveholding and the behavior in the 1860 election. And I hope that was useful to you as you can start to think about what prompts individual states' decision to secede. Okay? In January, you have a flurry of activity, right? Six states join South Carolina in leaving the Union. And I'm not going to get the order right here, but they're the Gulf states, right? Florida, Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, and Texas. Did I miss any?
Louisiana,
thank you. those six states join South Carolina, and in early February, they form the Confederate States of America. Okay. Texas is the last to join, and there's a nice little footnote here if you're thinking about where you live here in Colorado. Texas leaves officially on February 1st of 1861. That's the same day that Congress introduces a bill to organize the territory of Colorado, right? There had been repeated efforts to organize a territory around the gold fields. You remember I mentioned how many people had come here in 58 and 59. There's a desperate need for some kind of administrative body, right? It's far too far west from the center of Kansas to really be governed by Kansas, which is what it was part of. But finally, when enough Southern senators leave Washington, the Republican Party can essentially do what it wants with its Northern Democratic allies. And one of the first things they do is to admit Kansas as a free state on January 29th, and then a few days later to introduce a bill to organize Colorado. And at this point, despite the Dred Scott decision, the issue is really dead. Slavery will not be allowed in the territories in a Republican administration. Okay? So that flurry of activity comes, and it's a desperate time in this country. There's no president, right? Buchanan is essentially a lame duck. He is a lame duck. And Lincoln is president-elect. He has no power to do anything. And in the meantime, the nation is literally falling apart. Okay? But then think about this. On February 1st, Texas leaves, but then there's that long period where nothing happens, right? An agonizingly long period, if you think about it, right? All through February, all through March, when Lincoln gives his inaugural, and through the early part of April, nothing happens. And so Lincoln has some reason to believe that perhaps time is on his side, that perhaps the momentum behind the Confederacy has expired, right? And that it will be a limited rebellion, a rebellion of seven states, as opposed to any more. Okay? That's the point at which Lincoln gives his inaugural address. And I want you to remember that for all the states that voted in January and early February to secede, you have in your notes there that I handed out, keep in mind that there were several others that actually voted secession down, right? We've got Tennessee, Arkansas, Virginia, and Missouri, four states that explicitly defeated secession proposals. And then related to that, last night I read about another that I hadn't heard about. North Carolina doesn't even let the issue come up for a vote. So there's a strong strain of unionism in North Carolina as well. Okay. So for all the momentum in the Deep South, in the Gulf states behind secession, it does seem to me if you're paying attention to what's happening in state legislatures and state conventions, there's also reason for Lincoln to believe that perhaps secession sentiment is limited. And this is a belief that he will carry long into the war, that this is actually a rebellion motivated by a minority, not a majority, and that the vast majority of Southerners are actually are unionists, right, are loyal to the Union. So you can see when you pay attention to those election figures, even though the Southern Democrats dominated most states, they won most states, if you actually look at the popular vote, it's more complicated. Even a Gulf state like Georgia, right, gives an enormous number of votes to the Constitutional Union Party. And that tells Lincoln something about what might be the dormant or the latent sentiment. It turns out he holds on to that hope far too long, right? He thinks that the war will essentially be a limited war because of this latent unionism, and that's of course not the case. Nobody foresaw the war that would come. Okay. In early March, Lincoln gives his address on the 4th, and at that point, only seven of 15 slave states have decided to leave the union, right? So he has cause for some optimism. And I want to take a look at that inaugural address a bit here. First of all, I want you to try to imagine what it might have been for Lincoln to address a country as the newly inaugurated president when the country itself is beginning to fray and literally fall apart, right? His task is to both lay out his plan, right? That's the typical goal of an inaugural address. But at the same time, he's addressing a part of the country that claims that it's no longer an element of the nation, okay? And so he has a pretty tough goal in front of him, okay? And that's a nice, succinct statement of how Lincoln thinks about the nation, and that's part of the reason I assigned it to you. If you remember, he makes a few different statements about the nature of the nation, and that should evoke for you the kind of statements he made, particularly in the Peoria Address, and to a lesser extent in Cooper Union and to his debates, right? He sees the nation, or the Union as he calls it, as prior to even the Declaration of Independence. In fact, when I went back, he says, my eye fell on that phrase when he said, the phrase is to form a more perfect union. That's a phrase from the Constitution, right? A more perfect union. He takes that literally, right? That the job of the founders was to perfect what was already in place, what was already an organic understanding, not of colonies or states, but a larger body, what he called union. He actually believes that that's the sentiment that animates the revolution, right? Not just a desire to separate from Britain, but a desire to create something else, okay? And as we've talked about in past weeks, that's an unusual understanding of the union. It's the understanding that we have now, but at the time, of course, there was a rival understanding as well, one that became ever more important to Southerners to the point that when they declare themselves out of the Union, they draw on the Declaration of Independence, right? They see the Union as simply a compact, and when one party doesn't feel as though its rights are being respected in that compact, that party can withdraw support, right? That states freely give, but can also take away, right, legitimacy of a larger sovereign body. That's a fundamentally different view of what the nature of the United States is than the position that Lincoln's beginning to mount in his speeches in the 1850s and ultimately in his presidency. That's why, for him, secession is simply impossible. What does he say? Secession is anarchy, right? It doesn't make any sense. No government ever, no government ever provided for its own extinction, right? It doesn't fit with the entire idea of self-governance, right? So he spends much of his inaugural address laying out this vision of why the Union is, in his words, perpetual, right? It is unbroken and it is unbreakable. And so therefore, he simply does not recognize the withdrawal of seven states from the Union. And the way he's going to address it, as he says, is the mails will run, I will continue to collect revenues, right? And federal property will continue to be protected, okay? Southerners, particularly those in the Confederacy, read this with some trepidation. On the one hand, he seems like he's simply advancing a defensive posture, right? And that's the way Lincoln sees it himself. He sees himself as simply executing the laws, doing what he was elected to do. But for some Southerners, that's a provocative act, to not recognize the Confederacy. And of course, where the violence comes to a head is over federal property off the coast of Charleston at Fort Sumter. Okay? So I want you to think about that inaugural address in terms of what position Lincoln is mounting. Do you see that as a defensive maneuver on his part? Is it a provocative act? Is that a hostile speech? Because he explicitly addresses the Deep South in that speech, right? Of course, he's supposed to be addressing the nation, but he says, to my Southern friends, right? He ends the speech by again invoking those who have seceded, okay? That speech tells you a lot about how Lincoln sees the rebellion, right? and more to the point, how he will address it. Okay? We'll come back to the inaugural when we do some discussion in the second hour. But I want you to think about what happens next. After he gives the speech, again, he has some reason to think that it might have been a success, right? Or at least a limited success. Nothing happens, right? March is a relatively quiet month. But then, in a sort of inadvertent and backdoor way, there's a problem on the horizon. And the problem becomes manifest at Fort Sumter. When Major General Anderson, Robert Anderson, communicates to Lincoln that he has only enough supplies to feed his men for an additional 6 weeks, and then they will need to be reprovisioned. Okay. In January, Buchanan had tried to reprovision Fort Sumter, and Confederates had fired on the ship, the Star of the West, and sent it away. Right. So there had been an initial attempt that had failed. Lincoln insists on reprovisioning that fort, not rearming it, right? Simply resupplying it. And he makes clear to Southerners in South Carolina what he is doing, right, and why he is doing it. And they decide to go through with it. And if you're interested, I have the correspondence between Lincoln and Anderson and Gustavus Fox, who leads the expedition down there, where they're trying to figure out whether they have the right to do this. Lincoln, of course, insists that they do. He speaks with his cabinet. Some are more aggressive about wanting to defend the fort, and others say, let it go, right? And I want you to think about that. Should Lincoln have let it go, right? I know this is of special interest to you. I remember. Because the act of reprovisioning the fort does spark a response. And of course, the question is, who starts the war? Does Lincoln start the war by sending the provisions? Or does Jefferson Davis, the former Secretary of War and now the newly elected head of the Confederacy, does he start the war by authorizing forces in Charleston to fire on Fort Sumter? That's the key, okay? Because on April 12th, that's exactly what he does. And by April 14th, Anderson surrenders, right? And the Confederates take the fort, okay? That action motivates Lincoln to call up 75,000 volunteers, right? He calls up volunteers. Immediately thereafter, Virginia votes to secede. Now think about this. Virginia, if you look at those statistics we have, right, by far the most populous of the southern states, perhaps the most powerful of the southern states, a state with the absolute greatest number of slaveholders, although a small percentage of the total. Right? That state had voted not once, but twice to defeat secession, first in February and then again in April. But it was the calling up of the volunteers that motivated Virginians to switch their vote. Okay? And there's been some data done on the kind of people who vote for that. It's roughly those in the eastern counties, right, where the slaves reside, as we saw in those density maps. Roughly, that's where the vote comes, but not entirely. It's not a transparent reflection of the decision to secede. Slaveholding isn't everything. Nevertheless, it's that action that motivates the Virginians to decide, right? And in their wake, three more join: North Carolina, Tennessee, and Arkansas. Not in that order. Those are the three final states to join the Confederacy. Now, for Lincoln, of course, there are four more that are on the table that he has to worry about: Missouri, Delaware, Kentucky, Maryland, right? Four more slave states that could have joined the Union. And so I want you to think about the balance sheet, right? How would we judge Lincoln's success rate? The fact that, let's see, four remain in the Union, right? Those four upper border states. Is that an indication that Lincoln has held some of their loyalty, right? Or would you have expected even more of those states, right? Given the statistics that you saw about voting and about slaveholding, would you have expected more of those states to remain in the Union? Keep in mind, those that were last to join, most every one of those was a slave exporting state, right? And as we saw, if you look at the map, every state that initially joins the Confederacy is not only one where the Southern Democrats are victorious, is not only one where Lincoln does not appear on the ballot, but is also one that is importing rather than exporting slaves. Okay. Now, the state I want to focus on here is Virginia, because that's what you had some maps to look at as well. And I want to give you a little bit of background. But I think this is probably a good time for us to break. So why don't we take a break here? All right, and we're back. What I've given you now is a fairly bare bones narrative about the timing of secession. Right? Now I'd like to give you a couple different ways of looking at the kind of data that you studied to think about why particular states make the decisions they do. And like I said, what I'd like to do is focus on Virginia. What I've got for you here first is just a slide that I found this morning. This is one of the only images that we have of Inauguration Day, of Lincoln's speech on March 4th, 1861. This is an image we have from the Library of Congress, and of course the metaphor is so obvious, right? The Capitol Dome is yet unfinished. And it's such a nice picture of where, not nice is probably the wrong word, right? Because the nation's about to devolve into a bloody conflict. But I think you get the idea. What I want to focus on here are some maps, which should not shock you, right? You know what I'm interested in. And I had you look at some of these for our discussion today. Virginia finally made the decision to leave the Union right after Fort Sumter in April, right? And that decision puts Washington into an absolute fervor, right? This is right across the Potomac from the state that has seceded. And we see, among other things, a propaganda machine, and I think that's a good word. I don't use that word pejoratively, but a propaganda machine that begins to go into high gear to try to foment as much Union sentiment in Virginia as possible, right? It's actually in June that McClellan takes the earliest Union volunteers and leads them into an invasion of the western counties of the state of Virginia. His goal is to try to secure those counties to the extent that the people in those western counties who had voiced some anti-slavery sentiment or some Union sentiment, not abolitionist sentiment, to the extent that they can begin to form a government of their own. Because the idea is already in many people's heads in Washington that this area might actually secede from Virginia as it is a Confederate state, right? And this is an incredibly busy and fertile period for that kind of thinking. All through the summer, McClellan is fighting Lee in those western counties. These are some of the earliest skirmishes or battles of the Civil War, right? And what you're looking at here is a path-breaking map. This is a map dated June 13th, 1861. It is the first map ever made in the United States that attempts to put statistical information, the census, into cartographic form. Okay? The map was made by the United States Coast Survey, which you would never know, right? There's no indication on the map that the Coast Survey is the authoring agency. And you might be thinking, why on earth is the Coast Survey making a map of slavery? After all, its charges were to map and to chart the rivers and the coastlines of the United States. It was the most important scientific agency prior to the American Civil War. And when I came across this map several years ago, I had exactly that question. Why, on the eve of a military conflict, when surely they were in high demand, would the United States Coast Survey put some of its draftsmen on a task such as this, representing census data in cartographic form? And I want to tell you a little bit about why they did that. The first edition of the map is in June, right? Which gives us some indication that it was begun right after the April Declaration of Secession. So it is at the same time that this map is being issued, McClellan is fighting for those western counties to be secured for the Union. And that is all happening over the summer of 1861. Okay. What you see on the left side, if you took a look up close on your own time, what you have there is a list of all the counties in Virginia with their free population, their slave population, and the degree to which the slaves make up the total population. And they are ranked not according to total population density or even according to their geographic size. They are ranked on the left according to their dependence on slavery, right? And the idea is to give the viewer a clear sense of just how bifurcated the state's interests are, right? Anecdotally, Americans near or in Virginia knew that slaves were concentrated in the eastern part of that state, right? But this gives you a graphic picture. It could not be clearer, right, how little Western Virginians have in common with their eastern counterparts. And indeed, the idea was to foment rebellion within the Confederate state of Virginia, right, to foment secession from a seceded state. So here you have the first edition of this map. I've looked at lots of editions of these. A lot of them have notations toward the bottom that make it clear that these are being used by the military, that they're not just weapons of propaganda, but that they're also weapons of war, right? They're being circulated through the military arms of the Union, okay? You have some indication that the Coast Survey had success with this map because they reproduced it with subtle variations all through the summer. And that, to me, indicates not only that the map is being used in military circles, but it's also resonating with the public, right? There's some way in which this new representation of data, particularly about slavery, right, was having some effect. Now, the second one, you can see the most noticeable difference is that the Coast Survey has highlighted the western counties, right, that had met in Wheeling, Virginia that summer in August, and highlighted it almost as a separate state. Now, keep in mind, this is an August edition of the map, okay? This is long before West Virginia becomes a state, which indicates what a bold move the Coast Survey is making. They're actually suggesting that Kanawha, which is the original name for what becomes West Virginia, is a separate sovereign entity, right? And this is precisely the time that Western Virginians are meeting. McClellan has had sufficient success that they can actually peacefully meet in Wheeling, which is in the western part of the state, and they begin to form their own government. And the principle of their government is loyalty to the Union, right? Now, Virginia does not recognize this, and if you're interested, this becomes an ongoing issue. There's actually a Supreme Court decision in the 1870s because this question in the Constitution of whether you can create a state out of another state, we're not supposed to do that, right? But Lincoln ultimately feels that A, in wartime, all bets are off, and B, he recognizes that July that these are the representatives of Virginia, not of West Virginia. He says these are the representatives of the state of Virginia, because remember, he doesn't recognize secession, okay? So for him, as long as these people vote to become the representatives of the state of Virginia, and as long as Congress votes it, we can create a new state. And that's exactly what happens. And in 1863, I think in the summer, West Virginia is admitted to the Union and separated from Virginia. What you've got here is essentially the same kind of map that you saw first, again with the data on the left. Here, there's very detailed data that shows viewers just how much, even with this proposed separation, how the vast majority of slaves still reside in Virginia. Again, driving home that point that the state really is two states, and that what divides them more than anything else is slavery, okay? And then I think I might have, yes, a detail for you to see the way that they're experimenting with color to try to highlight the separation. Ultimately, if you know West Virginia, these counties are added as well. There's, I think, 11 or 12 more counties that become part of the official state of West Virginia, okay? So that gives you a sense of the way that the federal government is really making every effort, not just militarily, right, but also in terms of propaganda to try to foment that Union sentiment. And in Virginia, they hoped that they can do that. And the map showed them that there were perhaps pockets where slavery didn't dominate, and perhaps there was Unionist sentiment, right? If you think about how the Coast Survey made use of that map, this map will make sense to you as well. The Coast Survey reissues that map of Virginia several times, and they have success with it. And the reason I know that is that they mount this massive effort to apply the same techniques, not just to Virginia, but to all the slave states that is issued in September of 1861. And I have to tell you, this map has changed my life. I've been working on this map, as some of you know, for many years. It's become an utter source of passion for me, because it's not just a new cartographic technique, right? Like I said, this is the first time statistics has been translated by Americans into cartographic form. But what's more interesting to me is not just the new technique, but the way it shows Americans what's at work in this war, okay? The map is issued in September of 1861, and if you look through magazines from the period, if you look through government documents, you see that other agencies and magazines begin to imitate the technique, which indicates to me that this is really starting to catch on, right? People are using this technique. You see it in magazines like Harper's, for instance, okay? It's a popular technique for showing people the demographics of the war. And to me, this is a propaganda map, even though there's no overt propaganda on it at all, right? Because what does it show you? It shows you that this war is about slavery, right? Immediately, when I first looked at this map, I saw my eye went to the dark spots, right? That's where your eye goes. And pretty quickly, you realize that that's not just the heart of the Cotton Kingdom, but that's also the heart of secessionist sentiment, right? The Gulf states are the ones that lead the rebellion, right? And as you saw in your statistics for today, those are also the states that are most dependent upon slavery, okay? And in that respect, this is a propaganda document, right? It may purport to show just the facts, but what facts is it showing you, right? It's showing you what the Coast Survey believes to be the key to understanding how this war came about, okay? This map is particularly interesting if you look at this very subtle and quiet chart down here. Take a look more closely. The map maker has simply organized the data according to each state's dependence upon slavery. In the same way they did for every county in Virginia, here they've done it for every state, right? Do you notice anything unusual about that list? Go ahead, Elise.
The states with like a higher percentage of slaves seem to be the first to secede from the Union.
That's right.
The four with the lowest are the ones that didn't secede.
Very good. So not only do we have those with the most dependence on slavery at the top, right? Those were also the states almost in that precise order to leave the Union. It's not exact, but it's pretty close, right? Look at especially at that first wave. You see that? This is not quite right. But these are all states, except for Texas, that are actually exporting slaves. As Elise said, these last four have such a low percentage that they also, perhaps no coincidence, remain in the Union, right? It's a very subtle presentation of the data, but I don't think anybody who would have looked at this map in 1861 or during the war would have missed exactly what the message was, right? And that seems significant. Anything else about this data? This is the same data that I gave you in different form. Okay. Here's a detail from the map, and I wanted to show you this detail for a couple of reasons. First of all, if you remember back to the Virginia map, you may have noticed there was no scale of shade. What I mean by that is there was no legend in the corner that told you what the shading actually corresponded to. It's intuitive though, isn't it? Right? Anyone who's looking at that map, or this southern map, immediately knows that that shading corresponds to the density of slaves. And the way they've done it is the ratio of slaves to the total population. And I apologize that you can't read this, but each one is simply a number, right? And it shows you county by county. That's the only piece of information that's on the map. County by county, how dependent that area is on slavery. Okay? I wanted to show this to you also because initially, like I said, my eyes were drawn to the dark spots, right? And where you see the heart of what becomes secessionist sentiment. But for Lincoln, who actually looked at this map, and I'll tell you about that in a minute, I think his eye was equally drawn to the light spots on the map, which took me longer to really appreciate. Rich, you're nodding, right? What do the light spots on the map perhaps tell us? Any ideas? What might leaders have thought when they looked at this map? Go ahead, Cicely.
Well, for me, they're like obvious places where a situation like West Virginia might have occurred, where they would have been more inclined to share Union sentiment, and where, you know, Lincoln could direct his speeches like his inaugural speech.
Exactly, right. And we actually have evidence from him that he was hoping that what happened in Virginia might be replicated in eastern Tennessee, do you see, or other areas, northern Alabama, right? That there might be this latent sentiment that really just needs time and encouragement to flourish, right? And in that respect, the map might have actually misled him a bit, because he holds on to that hope. Perhaps it's a function of his own loyalty to the Union. He holds on to that hope that the South is full of Union sentiment, right? There's actually a statement that I found a couple weeks ago where he's speaking to General O.O. Howard, and he points to a map, not this one, but he points to the Cumberland Gap, and he says, "They are loyal there. I know it. They are loyal," right? And I have to think that a map like this is what encourages that sentiment. When you can see what no other map that he had access to showed him. Lincoln had access to thousands of maps, right? There was entire agencies at his disposal. But this is the only map that shows him what is literally invisible on any other map. Okay? Other observations about this map? We can spend more time on this in discussion. Go ahead, Rich. Hold on.
Seems like the majority of the states that, or the areas that are lightly shaded, is also along the Appalachian, where slavery might not be as prevalent just due to the agricultural nature of the land.
That's right. So that's right. And there's another map.
It might be misleading.
Say it again.
It might be misleading to see that's why there's not higher slave populations there.
That's right. And other people do different things with these maps. Sidney Edwards Morse, who's a Union loyalist, son of Jedediah Morse, he looks at that map, this map, and he actually turns it into a way to think about Union strategy. He says if we can control the Appalachians, right, we can control what is definitely underpopulated, but what essentially can bisect the Confederacy, right? We can cut railroad lines, right, if we can simply dominate the geography. Well, what brought him to that was not a topographic map, but a map of slavery. Right, that's how he came to think about that strategy. We might think that's a stupid strategy, right? But that's what brought him. That's what helped him think about that. Cicely.
You know how we've talked about how slavery is not necessarily or slaveholders were not the only ones who supported slavery, because people who didn't have slavery held it as kind of like an opportunity for social mobility.
Mm-hmm.
Was that sentiment by non-slaveholders, was that mostly concentrated in areas where they were like their neighbors had lots of slaves, or was that like in the Appalachians as well?
That's tricky. I did a lot of research when I found those maps on Virginia. So for instance, I know quite a bit about Western Virginia. And Western Virginia is not filled with abolitionist sentiment, right? It is not even necessarily filled with anti-slavery sentiment, but it is filled with resentment at the power of slaveholders in the eastern section. So we should be careful to differentiate that. And in fact, when West Virginia becomes a state, there's almost no slaves in West Virginia, but they pass some of the most rigid slavery laws ever on the books. Right, that only get overturned with the 13th Amendment. So it's not as though once West Virginia becomes a state, because it's filled with, or not filled with slaves, that necessarily it generates that anti-slavery sentiment. It's more loyalty to Union. So I should be careful about how I state that. Okay, Hunter?
I find it interesting that there's certain counties, even in the deep, deep South, that are less reliant on slavery than many of the counties that are in states like Maryland or Delaware that, as a conglomerate, aren't very reliant on slavery. Is that explained by, like, lack of agriculture, or, what are those isolated counties, why are they so similar to counties that are close to the Union rather than their own neighbors?
Well, some of it is, if you remember, our research on Virginia a few weeks ago that has the highest absolute number of slaves, but that hides the degree to which those slaves are leaving, or being sold, I should say. So that's one thing. And the other thing is, Virginia has a much longer tradition of dependence upon slavery. And so there was more slaves to leave. What this map doesn't show you, and I've showed you others that try to get at this, is a clearer sense of where slavery is growing and where it's declining, where it's a source of profit and where it's a source of stagnation, if not decline. Okay? Hayden had a question. Just hold one, just one second. They got to get the mic. There you go.
Well, I was curious for, like, maybe a reason why, like you were saying, it's not because of, like, anti-slavery sentiment. It's the reason why West Virginia stayed with the North. Would it be, like, kind of tied to the Grant essay where we read that, like, it's more, like, anti-Southern is why they allied themselves, like, with the Northern identity, you know? Like, instead of being, like, against slavery, they're with the Union because they're against, like, the Southern ideals. Does that make sense?
Yes, and I think more, to push it a little further, they may even fall under what Gnapp called that slave power conspiracy. West Virginia is very close in many ways to the Union. It's very close to the Ohio River, right? Very close to Ohio and Indiana. Those tendencies, right, or those orientations are very powerful. So it might have been that hostility to things Southern that relate or are a function of slaveholders' power. I think that's a fair way of putting it, right? Other comments about the map? This map is really, for me, an endless source of fascination, even though it's deceptively simple to look at. Let me show you why I know a little bit about what Lincoln thought of this map, and this was a real fortuitous thing for me. As many of you know, I teach a first-year seminar on Lincoln, so just if you haven't gotten your fill, and you'd like to hang out with some first-year students next fall. And when I first started teaching the seminar on Lincoln, I wanted to find images of Lincoln in popular culture. How we have thought about Lincoln over the last 150 years, because as you know, there's a little mini industry, right, about Lincoln, and he shows up everywhere. And I gathered all kinds of materials, and I was looking through some of them, and I came across this painting that I've come across many times before. You've seen this painting, whether in oil form here or in lithographic form. It is reproduced in countless textbooks of American history. In lithographic form, it was the cover of Doris Kearns Goodwin's Team of Rivals, which is a book about Lincoln and his cabinet. The painting is entitled First Reading of the Emancipation Proclamation by President Lincoln. It is painted by a man named Francis Carpenter, and it's painted in 1864. When Lincoln announced his intention to issue the Emancipation Proclamation in 1862, Francis Carpenter, who was a portrait artist, was utterly moved. He believed this to be a moment in American history second only to the signing of the Declaration of Independence. And he wanted to capture it on canvas. And he finagled, he made connections, and he really weaseled his way into living in the White House for 6 months. Lincoln was happy to have him take up residence. And he reproduces his studio in the executive mansion, right? And Lincoln often goes to visit him. Carpenter believes that he wants to reproduce every detail of that moment when Lincoln announced this decision of emancipation. And so for that reason, he moves into the White House. He studies all aspects of that moment. He recreates every member of the cabinet that was there. He also recreates the details of that moment, particularly the resources they use. You can't see it here with the lighting, but there are atlases, anti-slavery newspapers, and maps. Right? He wants to get everything right because he wants it to be realistic, nothing artificial, he says. Okay, so he spends all his time studying that moment. And because he saw Lincoln repeatedly using the slave map, he reproduces it here in the corner. Right? He saw slavery. He saw Lincoln time after time studying that map. Right? And to the point where he actually wants to reproduce it in detail here. So what he does is to actually take the painting, or take the map, back to his studio to reproduce it in detail. And one day, as Carpenter tells the story, he wrote a memoir about his time in the White House, one day Lincoln comes into the studio to relieve the pressures of the war, and he immediately comes and picks up the map and says, "Ah, you have taken my map. I've been looking everywhere for it." And according to Carpenter, he takes the map, he goes over to the window, he puts on his glasses, and he starts to study the latest maneuvers of the military. In this case, the failed raid on Richmond, which was in 1864. I tell you this story because it gives us a piece of evidence. It's just a fragment, right, that I found. But it indicates that even Lincoln found something useful in this map. Like I said a few minutes ago, it showed him something that no other map showed him. And it allowed him to think about the war as a way to destroy the Confederacy's greatest asset, right? We talked about this in the first few weeks of this class. Slavery is the Confederacy's greatest investment, its greatest source of labor, but also its greatest source of capital, right? It takes Lincoln a while to get there because, of course, in the inaugural address, he swears he will never touch slavery where it exists. Well, after a year and a half of warfare, he changes his mind, right? And that seems to me, I don't have evidence that this actually changed his mind, but I do believe that a map like this showed him resources in the South in a way that he couldn't see otherwise, right? And it allowed him to think about emancipation as not just a moral measure, but also a military measure. Okay? So I'll stop there just for a second. First, before we leave these maps, I'll leave them up, but other observations or comments you had, whether about the Southern map or the Virginia map. Colin, hold on just a sec. Go ahead.
I'm just wondering, the counties that aren't relying upon slavery, where do they get their investment into the war? Like, what makes them...
You mean, why do they fight for
war?
Well, that's unit two.
Exactly.
That's the next 3 weeks of our class.
Okay.
Do you have ideas about that? Why might people with no investment in slavery and no hope of owning slaves, why might they be willing to risk their lives?
Maybe it's just like the Southern ideals of that's what they run on.
That's part of it. Maybe there's a lifestyle that's too light of a word, but a way of life that they're fighting for. Other ideas? Why Southerners who had no investment in slavery might be willing to take such enormous risks to defend it? Rich?
It seems as though the destruction of slavery could destroy the whole South as a whole, which in theory it ended up doing, but it seems like they knew that by losing slavery they would in theory almost lose everything, so maybe that drove them to fight for the cause.
Mm-hmm. Right. This will be the source of our study for the next 2 weeks, where we look not just at the home front, but actually motivations for soldiers. Conversely, Colin's question could be applied to Northerners. Why might a Northerner who's agnostic about slavery, who doesn't care one way or another, right? Why might he be willing to volunteer for a cause like this? How does this conflict that is initially over slavery take on a cast of something much greater, right? That's a story that really is told best in stages, because the war is different in 1861 than it is in 1864, right? Those are two very different stages of the war. So let's think about that for a minute. I've tried to give you today so far a sense of how secession and the secession crisis in particular unfolds. And I want to know your thoughts, particularly, let's start with Lincoln, right? In your view, when you look at that inaugural address, how do you see Lincoln's response? Do you see that speech, for instance, as a hostile gesture towards the South? Do you see it as fairly conservative? What does Lincoln outline as his goals in the inaugural address? What does he promise that he will do? Any ideas? Hayden.
Shall we?
Yes, sorry. Yes, you should.
Well, I mean, it seems like kind of the whole theme of the entire speech is that, like, he's just going to continue to run business as usual. Like, there's a part that said, like, I'm going to do things as they were done before, and I'm going to do things so that it'll be the same for the next person, you know? And he says, like, and I'm just going to execute the laws as the people intend, like, as the executive branch, you know? And so it's, like, it's not up to me whether slavery happens or not, or whether any issue happens or not. It's up to the people and the judicial system. If this happens, is that the right idea?
That's right. He says repeatedly, you have been the aggressors, right? Not us in the Union. Emmanuel. He's right behind you.
Seems like he's trying to pacify throughout the speech. Like, even at the end, he says, like, we're friends, we're not enemies. And like Hayden said, he speaks about how he's still going to enforce the fugitive slave law, even though he thinks it's repulsive. Like, he takes a very pragmatic and a pacifying tone. Like, mm-hmm. like he says, yeah, I don't like slavery, but my goal isn't to eradicate it. It's just to contain it.
Right. He very strictly interprets his role as the executive, right? The executor of the laws, except for that thorny issue about slavery in the territories, right? Now that's a little bit more complicated issue, so let's see if we can figure that out. No matter how pacifying or conservative we now read Lincoln's speech, the fact is it did not convince seven states to come back, right? Which I think might have been his wildest hope, right? That this inaugural address might have brought back those Gulf states. So why didn't it? Why did they surely read that speech and remain out of the Union? Elise.
I think it has probably a lot to do with the fact that nowhere in his speech, or I think he said any time during the war, did he actually recognize them as a separate entity, as a confederacy. And I think that kind of provoked them into stirring up sentiment that, you know, they have the right to have seceded from the Union, and the fact that Lincoln doesn't recognize that just angers them and propels them further.
Oh, so it's not even his policy so much, it's just more of a visceral response?
I think that's part of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so part of it's anger. He hasn't given them the recognition that they want. But other ideas, and I don't have a great answer for this, why doesn't his speech, I mean, he essentially promises them, did you catch his proposed amendment in the inaugural address? What is he proposing? He proposes to sign an amendment into the Constitution to do what?
To protect slavery in the South.
To permanently protect slavery in the South. And in fact, this is the original 13th Amendment, right? Not the Emancipation Proclamation put into the Constitution. But the original 13th Amendment was to promise never to intervene with Southern slavery. Why isn't that enough? He has made it clear that he is not an abolitionist and that he knows that there are boundaries to his power. Travis, he's right behind you.
I would say that it's because they still have no say in the government. They're still outnumbered by the North in the electoral votes. Like his containment of slavery continues to give the South no say in government.
Okay, so there's a structural problem, right, that had been demonstrated in 1860, right? And in fact, Hunter, you wrote this in your paper, right? It's not the outcome of the 1860 election that outrages South Carolina. It's the very fact of the 1860 election, right, which cannot include them, right? Simply given the census statistics, right? What does it say? That you can't fight the census. That was in one of the readings for today. Emmanuel, go ahead.
We were talking about it after class on Tuesday about how I just think the changing of national political power was extremely important, because up till this point, the South had still pretty much had control over all federal government, and Lincoln represented a change, and that change represented a loss of trust. And like the documents 3, 4, and 5 that we read for Tuesday, like South Carolina in their proclamation for secession, they discuss how for 25 years we've been dealing with this, but now we can't take it any longer. So to me, that proves it. Like, they could deal with people in the North that didn't like slavery, but once those Northerners that didn't like slavery got into power, that was the last straw, and they couldn't deal with that. So they wanted to retain that sense of self-government and autonomy. And the only way they saw that was secession.
The way you're describing it makes it sound like the election is almost beside the point. Like the election is a demonstration, but it's the larger shift in power that's the problem for them to stomach.
Yeah, it just cements that shift in power that it was unprecedented up till that point, because, like I said, the South had controlled federal government up to that point.
Or at least had particular weight in it, yeah. Right? Or satisfactory weight. Although, remember, we repeatedly have read documents all through the 50s where Southerners voice a sense that they are a permanent minority, even before 1860. Now, Northerners voice the exact same sentiment, which should make you wonder. But each side seems to feel as though it's in the minority, right? The Republican Party in 1860 no longer feels as though it's in the minority. Hunter.
It sounds to me like an issue of independence. Like the South has already made it really clear, even before the war, that they don't feel like they're part of the country, that they don't want the North to have dominion over them. And in Lincoln's speech, not only, even though he is passive, he is very accusatory, and he also sounds to me sort of parental, like, we will allow you to do this. And he's still talking in us and them terms rather than us and us terms.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the South might have been offended not only by his accusations of their aggression, but also by, at least the Deep South, by his kind of, his tone of, like, overseeing mm-hmm. of the South. It's more like, it sounds to me even like a reconstruction before the war. Like, the North has control over the South in some sense, and by remaining independent, I think the South feels like they have control over their own affairs.
Mm-hmm. So even though from Lincoln's perspective he's being, what's the word? He's extending the olive branch, right? What does he say at the end? We must not be enemies. We are friends, right? And it's a very uplifting final paragraph. But for you, you see a different strain through the speech as well, right? One of, as you said, control, right? And one of a clear sense that they are in the wrong, right? That the rebellion, and he makes it clear, will be controlled, will be ended, right? Cicely.
I think, looking back on it, these seven states have had their taste of independence and what it's like to have a country on their own. And I think we've read documents talking about the South just having this distaste for continually bowing to the North. They feel like they're always compromising to what the North wants, and it's kind of like the last straw. It's one of the reasons they give for secession. You know, if you don't bow to us, then we're going to secede from the Union. And so now I think from the perspective of their own country, they don't have to worry about appeasing the North anymore, and they don't have to worry about those sort of differences, because even though they might have differences in the Confederacy, they see themselves as unified on the strongest issue that it had been in the Union.
And they're better mm-hmm. off out than in?
I think that would be the way that they would view that.
Mm-hmm. Right. And of course, we can't expect those who made this step, this drastic step, to foresee what comes next. Right? They couldn't have anticipated that. But let's stick with that just a second. What are the concerns of the secessionists? Why do they feel so violated to the point that they are forced not to accept Lincoln's authority, right? Lincoln hasn't done anything. Emmanuel and I were talking about this after class on Tuesday. We were hard-pressed to figure out what exactly happened after the election because nothing changed, right? And in fact, he professes that he will not change any federal policies. In fact, he will be more aggressive about enforcing the fugitive slave law, right? And protecting slavery where it exists. So let's try to be clear. What exactly were the rights that the Gulf states believed had been violated by his election? Because they talk about their rights in those documents in Perman for Tuesday, right? They speak of rights that have been violated. So what are those? Paul, give it a shot. Just 1 second.
In the South Carolina secession document, they say Lincoln is to be entrusted with the administration of the common government because he has declared that government cannot endure permanently half slave, half free, and that the public mind must rest in the belief that slavery is in the course of ultimate extinction. And so I think just the fact that the Republican Party itself ran on the platform of abolishing slavery in further states, or even just the anti-slavery in general. Seeing this, his statements in previous speeches or in the Lincoln-Douglas debates that are hostile to slavery, they just see any kind of accession of the Republican Party to the federal government as encroachment on slavery and their way of life completely.
So it doesn't matter that Lincoln hasn't done anything, that he promises not to legislate. You're saying the South Carolina document doesn't believe him, right? And B, they recognize that the government is now controlled by a party that is dedicated to halting the expansion of slavery. Now here we could go in an endless circle because we've talked about the way in which Southerners were not necessarily actively seeking new land, at least the vast majority of them. I simply don't believe that, right? Nevertheless, the fact of the Republican Party is a thorn in their side, right? It is a party that has openly made it their policy to criticize the backbone of the South's way of life. And so perhaps that's the conflict that they can't get over. Emmanuel and Jack?
And in that speech that Stevens gave, a quote that stuck out to me is when he says, we will be the architects of our own fortunes. Our destiny under Providence is in our own hands. So that just cements the the autonomy that they're obsessed with. They don't want to lose that sense of self-government.
Right, as Cicely said, they had a taste of it, right? It's a brief taste, but perhaps that was appealing, right? And the swiftness with which they elect a government is quite remarkable, right? As they will soon find out, and as we'll find out, it's difficult to fight a war if your principle is states' rights. It's very difficult to organize and marshal power, right? Particularly when they need to do things like suspend habeas corpus. That's difficult for the Confederate government to do. Jack.
Well, I think it goes to what you just said, states' rights versus union. And I think it didn't make any difference. They wanted states' rights, and they didn't want national government. And Lincoln represented national government.
Except.
And they didn't want to give away their freedoms mm-hmm. of states' rights. And whether it was slavery or anything else, they didn't want some big brother telling them what to do in their area.
True enough, except there are certain areas in which the South needs the federal government, right? Who will enforce the fugitive slave law? That takes a federal government, right? The Dred Scott decision is a statement about state rights, if anything, right? It's a statement that ultimately the federal government cannot control slavery in the West, in the territories, okay? These are ways in which the federal government is sometimes very handy for the South and the Southern states, and sometimes, like Jack said, is very much a hindrance to them, not just politically, but ideologically. Cicely.
Does the Confederacy try to pass legislation that mimics that kind of federal, I mean, you know, like the fugitive slave law and things like that? I mean, do they have a need for those, for like similar legislation, and do they attempt that, or?
Control of slaves?
Yeah, I mean, like how do they organize that over their adherence to states' rights?
We're actually gonna do this. We're gonna spend a whole day on the Southern home front, and we'll talk about that because in some ways, it is, like you said, a fairly uniform constituency, right? On the most important issues, they are in agreement, but there's also a whole lot on which they're not in agreement, such as a draft. Right? Can you force people to fight if you need to? Right? These become big issues, not just for Northerners, right? The question of a constitutionality of a draft, but also for the Confederacy, that's very backbone is rejection of federal power. So it creates problems for them. Hunter.
I think also it has to do with just kind of a like an inert irrationality, like we talked about before with the North thinking that there was some gigantic slave power conspiracy, especially in the Supreme Court with Southern judges present and things like this. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if there was a similar sentiment running through Southerners' minds, at least Southern slaveholders' minds, that especially with the emergence of the Republican Party, like we talked about before, where in the South it was viewed as more of an anti-Southern party than an anti-slavery party, that kind of an anti-slavery conspiracy would be going on in the North. And so I think that not all of the things that we're discussing can be explained just by looking back historically on the event rationally, when there was such emotional thoughts flying around and kind of different heated sentiments
and
at the time.
You see that in the Southern documents as well as the Northern documents in the Kent stamp, right? These are fervid kind of statements. What does Harris say? We stand facing a government that is revolutionized, right? Well, no, you've just lost an election. That's all, right? And yet it does seem as though the entire country for them is imploding. Now you introduced the term, so it's your fault, but here's the question. Did those states that seceded in that first wave, are they acting rationally? Are they acting in their best self-interest? Hunter said they may be acting irrationally at the time, right? Meaning that there's a lot of emotion. But now with 150 years of hindsight, can we look and say that they did see the writing on the wall, that ultimately Lincoln would do something very radical? Go ahead, Rory.
Well, I think it's clear from reading the address just how subtly threatening that Lincoln is being. The address is written with this undertone of, okay, well, we're giving you this one chance, okay? You have this one chance to come back.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Union predates the Constitution, and he goes into that extensively into the address. And he talks about how they're going to keep the mail going in the South.
and all of the federal services, and that he won't even use force to reinstall the federal services if they're expelled. But clearly, what he's doing, he's being a shrewd politician. He's giving them their chance, mm-hmm. and if they don't, then obviously we see what happens. You know, once Fort Sumter happens, all the bets are off. Everything in this address is now void, and federal troops are going to invade the South.
Well, some other things happen first, yeah. Right? But I, what you initially said, I think, is really key. For you, there's a very threatening, is the word you used, right?
Yeah.
It's very clear that the South, or these seven states, have an opportunity to come back.
Yes.
One opportunity to come back, right? Which raises the question, could Lincoln have done something more? But Elise, you had your hand up before.
I think that the southern states that did secede from the Union probably maybe had the same sentiments that Lincoln did about the fact that if this inevitably did come to a conflict, it would be more of a limited war as opposed to a total war. I don't think they really could have foreseen the demise that would have come with the total war. I don't think they're expecting it. And I think had they known that the conflict would have grown so out of hand and become so bloody, that they maybe would have taken the opportunity to rejoin the Union.
Mm-hmm. Right. There's certainly a lot of evidence in statements on the part of Southerners and Northerners in the late 1850s that when they talk of secession, they don't foresee a military response. They foresee, as Elise was saying, perhaps two separate nations side by side, right? And that leads to all other kinds of discussions, but it doesn't always necessarily mean that a vast military conflagration will ensue, right? It could just be secession, right? Matt?
So I think that in this inaugural address, Lincoln's really in between a rock and a hard place, because he can either decide to omit giving the southern states recognition, or he can decide to recognize them. And both of those acts are really, I mean, they can lead to conflict either way, because if he recognizes the states, then he's basically recognizing that they have the right to secede. So I think in his mind, that's out of the question. But he must realize that by omitting recognition, he's still inflaming their sentiment.
By not
recognizing them.
Mm-hmm.
Especially because for the South, it's such an honor thing.
Okay, good. Other thoughts about that? Could Lincoln have done more to avert the crisis or to curb it? Christina.
I think that from the Southern perspective, like, no, he couldn't. At this point, like, they couldn't back down. Same with, like, how they couldn't forgive Douglas. They can't compromise with the Union now that they've already, like, taken a stand against it. It's a Southern honor thing.
So was there anything Lincoln could have done?
I think that from their perspective, no.
Good. Others about that. Given what you read about the secessionists, and keep in mind we're reading the radical, fire-eating secessionist rhetoric, but from Christina's perspective, they've already decided, right? There's nothing that can bring them back. Other thoughts about that? Did Lincoln have ideas at his disposal that he could have taken advantage of? For instance, this is just an idea. Travis and I have talked about this extensively. Did he have to reprovision Fort Sumter? Let it go. It's one fort. It wouldn't be the first one they let go, right? So why does he take a stand there? And should he have taken a stand there? Anybody want to argue that he could have let it go? Elise?
I think even if he had let Sumter go, it would have still come to armed conflict eventually. We don't even know that they wouldn't have attacked Fort Sumter as soon as the provisions ran out anyways.
Mm-hmm.
And I honestly think that Lincoln, in order to avert the crisis, would have had to compromise with his own ideals. And as we discussed earlier, Lincoln refuses to compromise on the extension of slavery. And I feel like only him budging would have maybe brought the Confederate states back into the Union without an armed conflict. And he was not willing to do that, and for good reason.
So. Right. And the way you've put it is very good. Given what we know about Lincoln, right, most importantly in the inaugural, given what you know about the radical leadership of those first states to secede, right? Is there any room for compromise? Is there anything that could actually happen? And I'm not sure. If you have an idea, I'd love to hear it. Cicely.
Well, it's kind of combining these last two points that we've talked about, but I think the biggest threat that the South felt was seeing themselves as a minority based on, you know, like this sectionalism of their party. And what basically divided that was the slavery issue. And so as long as they're holding on to that slavery issue as like the defining cornerstone of their party, they're limiting it to that minority status where they can't win. And so that makes it a really logical reason for, you know, seceding and maintaining their secession. And then on top of that, I don't really think Lincoln has room to budge because he's built his platform on, you know, we're going to keep slavery where it is. And as long as the South, like, chooses to hold, like, to stick to their guns, essentially, then you're really at a stalemate either way and you've come to war.
Right, right. And Rory put it nicely. Lincoln is a very savvy politician. And there's room to be creative there, but you are also the representative of your party. He has been elected as a Republican, right? So as much as we'd like to see that flexibility, perhaps, in that inaugural address, there's not a lot of latitude he has on that, right? He was elected to fight against Dred Scott, for instance, right? And doesn't he say in the inaugural address, here's the things that we actually disagree on. You believe that Congress should not be able to disallow slavery from the territories. We do believe that Congress should. Does the Constitution say no? So we put it to a vote and you lost, right? You lost an election, right? But for them, it's not just an election, right? The election is, as Fehrenbacher said, and you said, it's the thing they can point to. It's the manifestation of that permanent inequality that we've talked about. Right, that they find themselves a permanent minority. Go ahead.
Could his provisioning of Fort Sumter even be partially based in politics, like differentiating his action from Buchanan? You know, because Buchanan let it go after he tried, and so Lincoln could be making it partially politically in differentiating himself as well as, you know, trying to make a point of nonviolent
yep.
support.
Absolutely. One of my favorite historians, Ken Stamp, historians of the Civil War said, this is exactly what Lincoln does. It's a beautiful convergence of his ideas. The Union must be protected, right? Federal property must be protected, and a strategy of defense. Call it a passive strategy, right? But what does it force the Confederates to do? Fire, right? Hunter.
I think in part, too, the ceding of Fort Sumter would be kind of an implied recognition of secession, because if the Confederacy were to draw a map somewhat like this of the area around Fort Sumter, that they would clearly have divided it as part of their territory after the fact.
Yes.
And therefore, if he simply lets it go and cedes it to the Confederacy, then he's not only confirming to them that he recognizes them, but in the North as well, there's going to be kind of sentiment that, you know, he's recognizing that this is another entity, that this isn't just part of the Union.
Right.
And by not ignoring the issue, obviously he supplies Fort Sumter, but by disregarding the fact that it's threatened by Southern forces, he's in a sense, not only is he forcing them to fire first, but he's also not recognizing them still. He still refuses constantly to recognize that this is a war between two entities mm-hmm. rather than an uprising, an insurrection.
Yes, and he continues to use that language, uprising, insurrection, rebellion, right? Only later does he begin to call it a war, because it takes time for it to become a total war. But it's premised, like you said, on his belief that he is simply conducting the government, enforcing the laws as he was elected to do, right? And the way you've described it makes it sound like his hands really are tied, right? By not reprovisioning Fort Sumter, he's not differentiating himself from Buchanan, right? And essentially, he's not protecting the Union, right? That means to protect federal property. So there's not a lot he can do there. Now, whether that was a kind of happy coincidence or not, that's a poor way of putting it. Because, of course, in a way, he loses, right? The firing on Fort Sumter, not only do they lose the fort, but immediately thereafter, four other states go to the other side. And that's a tough question. Is that a loss, right? He manages to keep four. He's happiest about Kentucky, and we'll talk about why next week. But that's a tricky division for him. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Stephen.
Well, I think it's also, if he didn't resupply Fort Sumter, not only does he cedes it to the South, but I think another like major consideration is foreign recognition as well. Because if Britain and France recognize the Confederacy as its own country, then like at that point, there's nothing really you can do about it. And like they always mention the Revolutionary War, where we were able to win with the help of the French because of foreign intervention to help us win the war. So if they get foreign recognition, if they cede Fort Sumter and they recognize them more as a country, and France and Britain recognize them, like the game's already lost. Like then it's no longer a rebellion. Then it's actually two countries fighting each other. So it's not only in the North, but also like world stage. You can't let other countries have the opportunity to recognize the Confederacy as its own sovereign country.
That's right. So he doesn't have his eye just on the South. He's also looking across the Atlantic, right? And the British go right to the brink of that, right? The Queen recognizes some aspects of the conflict, but never recognizes the Confederacy as such. So the Union is grateful for that. And there's a very, very serious persuasion effort, I'll say, in London going on and in Paris to keep the British and the French out, to keep them from overtly recognizing the Confederacy. They get involved in other ways, but not in the formal way, which really was, as Stephen said, going to be a devastating loss for the Union if the Confederacy was actually recognized as a nation, right? That's a huge step for them. I saw some other hands. Elise, go ahead.
I just had a quick question.
Sure.
Was there any other points after Fort Sumter in the war where the Confederacy was really on the offense as opposed to the defense?
You mean winning?
No, just like first to fire kind of a thing.
Aggressive, yes. Well, the whole war becomes that, right? And in fact, Rory and I have argued about this, but he's quite right. In the first year, 16 months, the Confederacy really is ahead of the game, right? And they're ahead of the game in terms of intelligence. They're ahead of the game in terms of the number of battles they're able to win, or at least not lose, right? Given their inferior strength, numerical strength, that is, and inferior resources. And then, of course, there's two moments at which they invade the North, right? Antietam and Gettysburg, which, not coincidentally, are seen as two of the most important battles of the war. When they're forced back, right? Okay, any other ideas about how you assess what happened here? Did the secessionists go too far? That is to say, did they act rationally? Could Lincoln have done more to avert the crisis? Any other ideas about that strategy? Because now I'm gonna ask you the tough question. And if you can't answer it, that's okay. Who started the war? And I don't really have a good answer for that. But in your mind, given everything we've looked at, particularly in the last week, do you have a strong sense of who's responsible for starting this conflict? And don't say the Pilgrims in 1607. That's just unfair, but probably true. Any ideas? Anybody want to give it a shot? I don't want to play the blame game, but I do think it's an interesting question. Go ahead.
I believe that both the South and the North had their fair share in starting the war. It was ultimately both sides just disputing over one, like states' rights and slavery, was ultimately like the reason for the war. It was Fort Sumter, like Lincoln had to reprovision Fort Sumter, for example, because he had to preserve the Union. That was the most important goal. That was the Declaration of Independence was designed around. The framers of the Constitution wanted us to become one nation whole and not have any of this happen. That's what the Constitution was designed to do. But ultimately, like, it was just a dispute because both sides entered the war at the same like general time because there's nothing you could do. It had to happen. It had to happen.
Given the state of where those two positions were.
Yeah, given the state of where their dispute, like if you're in an argument with, say, a sibling, you're not gonna like give in on your side if you're really passionate about the argument, and this is like a really passionate argument, it's states' rights and slavery. These are two like defining moments in American history or defining like disputes in American history. And ultimately there is nothing you can do to like stop it. You could let it go on and go on forever, but ultimately, at some point, both sides are just going to go over the breaking point, and it's going to have to happen in order for one side to win and one side to lose. You can't compromise and have both sides win. Mm-hmm. That's just impossible.
I like the way you, the first thing you said was Lincoln is sworn to preserve the Union. That's the most important thing to him. And in fact, as we move forward, a lot of Lincoln's policies will make sense to you if you keep what Dylan said in mind. Lincoln's most important goal is to preserve the Union. Except, here in the secession crisis, did he do everything he could to preserve the Union, right? It sounds like, based on what we've talked about, that his hands were essentially tied. He does the few things that are open to him, right? He gives the kind of promises that he's able to promise politically and as the executive, right? But he cannot, the one thing he cannot compromise on in preserving that Union is the extension of slavery into the West. That is the single thing that he will not bend about, right? And that will give you some sense of how he wants to preserve the Union. That is to say, he doesn't want to preserve the Union at all costs, right? Because some things, for him, are the bedrock of the Union. And the extinction of slavery is one of those things, okay? And that it's that convoluted, contingent part of his belief in Union that I think will help you understand his policies, okay? Any other comments? Cicely.
I almost want to point the finger at Stephen Douglas back with like the Kansas. I know.
I was waiting for somebody to.
Me. But like back with the Kansas-Nebraska Act, because it wasn't, I mean, it's further away from the war than more looking at the directly like the election of 1860. But I feel like directly resulting with like Bleeding Kansas, where you have John Brown and Pottawatomie, and then you have the caning by Brooks of Sumner. I think you see those first, or the inception of the fighting sentiment and the actual violence over the issue. And so I think that's where you first get the idea where war kind of breeds, even though they're not like all out sections. You know, you see the violence occurring over that issue.
Over Kansas.
Yeah.
Over the expansion.
Over slavery.
Right, right. So blame Stephen Douglas, which is ironic because as you saw in some of the reading today, for a long time in American history, Stephen Douglas was upheld as the last great compromiser, right? But of course in 1860, this is so ironic, no one will listen to him, and for good reason, right? Yeah. He can't square his support for Dred Scott with his support for popular sovereignty. Northerners and Southerners see that, right? So it's ironic that for many people, he is seen as the guardian of the Union. He certainly sees himself that way. But for Cicely, if we look back at where the violence started, right, it started over the extension of slavery, right? At least insofar as the North is in conflict with the South. That slavery is obviously an institution of violence, right? There's tremendous violence in the South. But where it begins to be a source of sectional conflict is always about the growth of slavery into the West. That's very good. Okay. Any other final thoughts? Matt.
So I think you could probably argue that Lincoln provoked an attack by the South at Fort Sumter, but first of all, I don't think if he had chosen not to put the provisions there, that would have been viewed as weak leadership by the rest of the Union, and that could have led to further disunion in the northern states, potentially. So I think he didn't really have a choice, and I think it really comes down to it being the South's fault for starting the war, because he, maybe his act was provocative in provisioning Fort Sumter, but in reality it was a defensive move, and it was the South that took the first offensive move.
So, took the first offensive,
yeah,
strictly,
I mean,
understood it.
Once again, people's decisions matter, and the South took the decision to fire on Fort Sumter. Mm-hmm. And that's the first deliberate offensive attack.
That's right. And you remind us of what's behind Lincoln. Lincoln is not acting on his own, right? He has a constituency. And the documents you read from Stamp today give you a sense that it's not just Southerners who are hot under the collar about this, right? But Northerners too, magazine editors and speakers. Lincoln's own law partner, he says, let's have it out now, right? The fight, we're up for it. If it's going to come, let it come now. So they too would have seen, as Matt said, an inability to defend the Union as an act of submission, right? And so Lincoln really is, I guess the more I think about this inaugural address, the less latitude I see him really having, given the constraints around him. Hunter.
I tend to agree with Matt. I think that Lincoln had incredible foresight with his decisions at this time, especially in regards to Fort Sumter, that he wanted to make sure that this went down in history as a war that was started by the states seceding. And that's why he originally refused to recognize the Confederacy and also kind of tried to act like it was just business as usual for the Union. That, you know, forts need to be resupplied, so I'm sending supplies to Fort Sumter. What are you going to do about it? And like you said, they ended up firing first. And I think that's why I would say that the South did start the war, is because of the great pains that Lincoln took to make sure that that was the way that events unfolded. Mm-hmm. Now, that said, if you want to see Lincoln's refusal to accept Southern secession as a act of aggression, or then that ideological kind of attack would be the beginning of the war. But
right, that's right. All right, we've got a ton of ideas here about where the war actually begins, who's the first provocateur. I want you to bring all these to class on Tuesday as we just move from the secession crisis into the actual structure of the military strategy, so we'll have even more fun. Thank you so much. I was going to thank you for coming, but of course you have to be here, right? You're my students. All right, have a great weekend, and I'll see you all on Tuesday.
Next week on Lectures in History, Colorado School of Mines professor Kenneth Osgood looks at the CIA and regime change in the Cold War. Professor Osgood discusses several examples of the CIA's involvement in covert regime change operations, including coups in Guatemala in 1954 and in Chile in 1973. Join us each Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. for classroom lectures from across the country on different topics and eras of American history. Lectures in History are also available as podcasts. Visit our website at cspan.org/history/podcasts or download them from iTunes.